Well, it hardly seems like it, but next month will mark 7 years since I first came to Seattle. And sometime in that first year here, as Kathy and I lived down the street just several blocks, I was walking to church early one Sunday morning and saw a woman walking toward me on the sidewalk. We were still about a block away from each other. She hadn't yet noticed me, but when we got a little closer, she looked up, saw my clergy collar, panicked, and darted to the other side of the street. No more eye contact after that. I chuckled at the encounter, or the non-encounter as it may have been, which has happened a few times since then. Some in the nun zone must apparently think that the priest is just lurking in the neighborhood looking for someone to accost and force-feed them with the religious drivel that we have to share, right? But the irony of that encounter and the others that have happened since is not lost on me, and I always think of the image of this parable of the Good Samaritan, as it is called, with the priest and the Levite being the ones who crossed to the other side of the road. And it helps me remember that we all have our moments, right? The parable of the Good Samaritan is perhaps the best known story in all the Bible, known well beyond the hallowed halls of churches. Many want to make it a lesson in morality. Do good unto others as you would have them do unto you. Nothing wrong with that, but that's not what this parable is really about. Even the moniker Good Samaritan is a misnomer. Nowhere in the passage is the Samaritan called good. Well, sure, he was good to the victim, but if we leave it at that, as just being good, offering an act of kindness, it misses the deeper truth that's being offered by Jesus in the parable and in the encounter that he describes. The deeper truth being about the quality and character of neighborliness. It's about the relationship, not about the act of kindness. He and the lawyer both knew the book of Deuteronomy well. They both go there for the launch into their conversation. We would do well to begin there as well. We hear a passage from Deuteronomy this morning. Deuteronomy, Old Testament book, Deutero, meaning a second telling of the book of Exodus. That's what it is. It's a retelling of the story of the emancipation of the Hebrews out of Egypt. And in the retelling, it invites every generation of biblical people of faith that have followed since to retell the story of the Exodus in their own generation. In Jesus' generation, that's the invitation. In our generation today, it's the invitation to us. Now, the great Old Testament theologian Walter Brueggemann, whom we've had here a couple of times in recent years, and I would recommend just about any book he's ever written, Brueggemann offers, I think, a very helpful parsing out of Deuteronomy, this book, which he suggests is really a retelling of the tension between two worldviews. The one that operates off of what he calls protocols of purity, which exist in every culture across time, and what he says are protocols of neighborliness, into which the book of Deuteronomy and by extension Jesus call us and invite us over and over again. But to begin and understand this book of Deuteronomy, we got to go back to the Exodus. You know this story. I mean, think Charlton Heston and Cecil B. DeMille and Hollywood, right? The Hebrew people are victims. They're enslaved. They're victims of a predatory economy down in Egypt, in Pharaoh's land. That is, they are in bondage there until they are emancipated from that predatory economy and delivered by God into an alternative one grounded in abundance. And they are invited to see and celebrate that abundance as a gift from God. The manna that falls from heaven in the wilderness that offers them the food every day, the bread of heaven that we say around the table we share even now, These are offered as a sign of the abundant gifts of God. And the Ten Commandments, not the things on the stone tablets, but the Ten Commandments are offered to the community as a guide by which the people can administer abundance for all. That's what those Ten Commandments really are. But the protocols of purity that are outlined there tilt towards scarcity. They're about stratifying the community into levels of rightness. Arbitrary distinctions grounded in fear, usually. Every culture has them, including ours. We all do this in our lives, and people suffer as a result. These protocols of purity are designed to demean some people who are considered less pure. The historical ones include women and people of color, gays, lesbians, trans, immigrants, or foreigners. And when the community, or the society as community, sanctions ritual demeaning, which is what those protocols do, when it sanctions ritual demeaning, it inevitably leads to exploitation of those people, either explicitly or through limits on access to things like housing and education and jobs and voting and healthcare. It is a violent way of being in the world. Surely we can say that our society continues to operate on such protocols. And we, all as biblical people of faith, would do well to reflect on how we serve as accomplices to such a system that inclines back to that predatory ways of Pharaoh and refuses to believe that a realm of abundance can and does exist. Deuteronomy names all of this in its retelling of the story. And it invites us to retell the story in our own time, here and now, in our own community, so that we might do it differently. And the book doesn't stop with those purity codes. It devotes even more ink to the protocols of neighborliness, what it means to be neighbor to one another, and to hold the tension between those two alternate visions of the world. This morning we heard a brief passage from the 30th chapter of Deuteronomy summarizing much of this, but if we go a full 15 chapters prior to this one that we heard read this morning, it is a litany of instruction and guidance after guidance on how to treat one another, how to treat your neighbor. It's about relationships. So let me just name a few examples out of this book. Chapter 23, it says, "Do not charge interest to your neighbors when you give them loans." It also says, "Don't collect collateral on the loans you do make to your neighbors." Well, it doesn't actually say, "Don't make the collateral, don't require collateral." It says, "You can require collateral by having the person to whom you're giving the loan give you their coat. You can hold that as collateral, but you must return it every evening so that they can stay warm. Then you can get it back the next morning, and then give it back the next night, and give it back the next morning." Brueggemann says, "Try that for a 30-year mortgage, and you won't want to collect collateral." The point is, he is your neighbor. Do not treat him poorly. Do not make him suffer. Chapter 24, "Do not practice wage theft. Pay the day worker his pay on the day he does the work." He is your neighbor. He needs to feed his family. Chapter 25, "Do not have two weights and measures, one for the poor and one for the rich. Think payday loans today and the usurious rates that they charge people who can least afford it. They are your neighbors. Don't do that," the book says. And speaking of the poor, "When you harvest your grain or your grapes or your olives, do not gather in the gleanings from your field or your vine or your trees, but leave them there for the widow, the orphan, and the immigrant." Those who eke out an existence on the lower rungs of the economic ladder. They are your neighbor, it says. Share your wealth with them, it says. Be generous because God has been generous with you. And here's the most important directive, I think, in the whole book. It's from chapter 15. It says, every seventh year you shall forgive the debts of your neighbor. Just forgive. So that there will be no one in need among you. No one in the community will be impoverished. If you live according to this alternative vision of the world that the God of your emancipation has shown you, then abundance will flow to all. Every seventh year, you shall forgive the debts owed by your neighbor, because God, your God, has delivered you out of your bondage in Egypt. Now, I'm something of a biblical language nerd, and there is something really fascinating about this piece right here that I want to share. Slight digression. The Hebrew of the Old Testament doesn't have adverbs the way that we have adverbs. So if the Old Testament Hebrew said, give very generously, it doesn't have the words for very or generously. Instead, they use what's called an absolute infinitive, which would be the verb repeated for emphasis. So instead of give very generously, it would say, give, give, give. And here's the thing. This one from Deuteronomy 15, in this directive about forgiving the debts of your neighbor, Moses or whoever it was that wrote this used six infinitives to make his point here. Six infinitives. Forgive, 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 forgive. Meaning, I really mean this. I really want you to pay attention here. Six infinitives. More than any other place in all the Bible. There it is. And Jesus and the lawyer talking centuries later would have both known that. But we can make the parable of the Good Samaritan a sweet tale about a kind outsider who took care of a hurt man and leave it at that. Or we can interpret it as a moral fable to do good, to be kind to others. But if we leave it there, we will miss the deeper invitation to abundance and all the ways that the invitation to see and care and love your neighbor might inform our lives today. It's about relationship, folks. It's not about the act of kindness. And if we leave it at that, we will miss the invitation to consider how we, as people of biblical faith, might have what we might have to say to the powers that be in our society today that hold fast to the protocols of purity, which manifest in so many ways in our time. Manifest as the staggering weight of economic exploitation borne by those with student loans, or the exploitation in the subprime usury in the housing market, or just this week when we saw in the news that immigrants were being applied compounding court fees up into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, which they can't possibly repay, simply to criminalize their immigration status. Or the purity-driven bail system that we have in our nation that has so distorted things that a full 70% of people residing in local jails in this nation have not even been convicted of the crime. They are there because they cannot post bail. That is wrong, folks. And this parable says something about that for us here and now. They are our neighbors. Teacher, what must I do to have eternal life? And Jesus responded, what is written in the law? The law of neighborliness is clear, folks. We must practice abundance. Because the God of abundance has delivered you and me out of the bondage into freedom, to live into that abundance. Why? Because God loves us and through us wants us to demonstrate that love to all the world. But Jesus is asking us to retell the story here and now that it might change that world. But also, he is asking us a very keen question of our own spiritual survival, which is, will we be people of faith who hold fast to a system of stratified purity and the economics of scarcity and violence? Or are we willing to be courageous people of faith who work for an alternative vision in which God's abundance flows through us out into the world, such that no one is suffering? Go, he says, and do likewise to your neighbors. Or he might have said, go, 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 go. 7 times.